Sammasambuddho Soakkato Yena Bhagavata Dhammo Suppatipanno Yassa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Tamayang Bhagavantang Sadamang Sasangang Ime hi sakave hi yatavahang Avopite hi abhipu jayama Sadhuno bhante Bhagava suchira parinibhutopi Pachima jnata nukampamanasa Ime sakare dugata panakalabhute patiganhatu Amhakang dikaratang hitaya sukaya alahang sammasambuddho bhagava buddhang bhagavantang abhivademi suvakkato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Iti piso bhagava alahang sammasambuddho vijjacharana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purissa dhammasarati Sata deva manusanang buddho bhagava tamahang bhagavantang abhipujayami tamahang bhagavantang sirasanamami Suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichi patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho yaditang cha tari purisa yugani ata purisa pugala esa bhagavato savaka sangho Ahuneyo, pahuneyo, dakineyo, anjali karaniyo, anuttarang punya ketang lokasa tamahang sangang abhipujayami tamahang sangang sirasa namami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, or missing none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the sky and downwards to the depths, upwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views. The pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
More than the three he's.
Why not? So now we have the opportunity to answer questions. See what's in the box tonight. Oh, the first question. Dear Ajahn, does walking meditation have the same effects as sitting down does? I feel more calm and peaceful doing so. It's working for you. Great, yes. So many people get enlightened doing a walking meditation. Some doing sitting meditation. So the thing to do is to do both. And I didn't explain, I'm not sure if I did explain, because too much about walking meditation. One of the great things about walking meditation in these rooms here is you can always put the aircon on if you want to, because the aircon machines are in there, which means that if it's too hot in here, you can go in there. If it's too cold in here, you can go in there and put the heat up, or whatever. In other words, it'd be comfortable for you. And number two, wherever you start on the walking path there, you always end up back where you started. You don't get anywhere. And that's a wonderful thing about walking meditation. People always want to do something to get something. And here you just start at one end, go to the other end, and come back again. You end up where you started. So that's really nice. And number two is keep your eyes open. Don't close your eyes, otherwise you'll hit the wall. But put your gaze maybe, usually I say a body length in front of you. Sometimes before I used to say a couple of meters, and people got out tape measures because they want to do it perfectly. No, just roughly, so you can see where you're going. So you can see the wall in plenty of time. And if there's anything on the path there, you can always make sure you don't step on it. And so eyes about, say, 1.5, 6, 7, 8, whatever, however big you are, meters in front of you. And not to the left, not to the right, just look in front of you. And you put your hands wherever they're comfortable. And then you start walking. And when you start walking, just lifting your feet. What's it like to lift your foot? So you become this observer of all these incredible sensations of just walking. And it's great to take your socks off when you're doing the walking meditation, because then you can actually feel. You can feel the foot go down onto the yoga mat. And then when it touches there, you can see which it touches first. And when you lift your leg up, which part of the foot leaves the mat first? Does it go straight up? Does it go back a bit? Does it go forward? How do you walk? And you start to notice all the incredible number of sensations just with one step. And that becomes just one step, and then the next step, then the next step. Don't have a race to see who goes slowest, as I said the other night. Just do it naturally and just see what happens. And of course, you know, my walking meditation story, that when I first became a monk, I loved my walking meditation. And so I was in Bangkok, and they used to have some chanting in the morning, and after the chanting, I could do my walking meditation for an hour. And I didn't know how to walk slow or fast, I just walked naturally. And it became really slow, all by itself. And, well, it was not as long, or maybe it's long, this hall over here. It took me half an hour to get from one end to the other and half an hour to get back again. Because they had installed a grandfather clock in the hall. Why they wanted to install a grandfather clock, which banged every quarter of an hour, ding dong, was beyond my comprehension. But nevertheless, it helped me because I knew exactly, you know, what the time was. I didn't need to look at clocks because I could hear them. So I started walking. It used to take me half an hour to get from one end to the other and half an hour to come back again. And you get very peaceful. And on one of those mornings, I was walking just really nice and still just watching all these incredible movements of one foot as it lifts up and starts to lift up. And go. And I heard a sound like 100 miles away. Lama Wang So is my name. Lama Wang So. And I realized that a monk was shouting in my ear about this far away. Because you're really focused and getting very still, it sounds like it's a million miles away. And then, of course, you know, you started contemplating why. I remembered I was supposed to go to a house blessing that morning. I'd forgotten all about it. Can you hear okay? Yeah. I was supposed to go to a house blessing that morning. I'd forgotten all about it. And they were waiting for me. They sent someone to come and get me. And I was just really nice and peaceful. And so I realized that it's my mistake. So I had to get my act together. It's like when you're driving a car, you have to go up the gears again to go up to normal gear, because I was going incredibly slow. But then as I was moving my head around to meet this monk's gaze, it's incredible the number of sensations, just by moving your head, or what you have to do to moving. It was fascinating. And it took me about 3 minutes to turn my head around. But because it was a monk sent again, he knew exactly what I was up to and why I couldn't move very fast. And as soon as I got eye contact, what? It's when you're really cool and peaceful, it's just so hard to, you know, to get going again. So eventually I sort of, you know, came out of my beautiful peaceful and then just got to go to the Dharana. He understood all about it. I was meditating. That's a nice thing to do. So it wasn't really a bad thing that I was late. But nevertheless, it just showed me just how peaceful you can get in doing walking meditation. Totally in your own little quiet world. And it's so peaceful. It's so nice. You don't have any problem with, you know, aching leg or aching back or falling asleep or being restless. So walking meditation is great. As the Buddha said, do walking meditation, then do sitting meditation, then do some walking meditation. When you get very peaceful, sometimes you know now is the time to sit down. That's why we have these halls all together here. So you can sit in meditation, sitting meditation, walking meditation, all very convenient for you. So that's how you do the walking meditation. Just see how peaceful you get. Okay, the next question. If you want to do it outside, that's also good. But you know, these places here, they're just so close to where you can sit, sit and walk, sit and walk. I know that some places they say you should just sit for an hour, walk for half an hour, but I don't like those time constraints. Because sometimes you're sitting meditation, it's so peaceful, you get really nice and quiet, and then somebody rings the bell, bang, and you have to get up and do. Oh, imagine that happened to the Buddha. Imagine that the Buddha was under the Bodhi tree, about to get enlightened, and bong, had to go and do some walking meditation. That would be terrible. So instead of that, just keep it natural. You're sitting, it's nice and peaceful, just carry on. No aches and pains, just get deeper. And then it's time to go to do some walking meditation, and do the walking meditation, however long you want. And don't compare yourself to other people. No measuring. Dear Ajahn, holiest of all donuts. Am I the holiest donut? You know that sort of Ajahn Chah, he was fat. And I think he was more holy than I was. Or ham or whiz or whatever. And who else was fat? Oh, my preceptor, he was fat. And who else was fat? Oh, the person who was my mentor. You know when you're very young, sometimes you look up to somebody and you think, wow, that's the sort of person I would like to be when I grow up, especially in the spiritual world. And the person I was really inspired by, and oh, it's just even today I'm inspired by him. He's incredibly generous, really, really kind. And, you know, I always see him, and he was old when I was young, and he's still alive today. I still see him every now and again. There's a gentleman called Santa Claus. Fat and happy and generous. And sometimes I think, hey, why is it that sort of fat people are usually very kind and happy? And because I was a scientist, I thought there must be something behind this. Why are the fat people you see are always kind and happy? And thin people are often, not all thin people, but a lot of thin people are really miserable and nasty sometimes. So then I started thinking, and I found the answer in the Science Journal. Because what happens is that your blood vessels, when you're happy and in a good state of mind, laugh a lot, or just kind to other people, when you're a happy person, your blood vessels actually get larger. They actually expand. This is not Ajahn Brahm making a joke. Not yet anyway, but that's facts. And when you get really miserable and upset or something, your blood vessels, they contract. So if you are fat and you have lots of stuff going through your blood vessels, if you're fat and miserable, it's called double whammy. Double whammy means you get extra gut going through your blood vessels, and they're very thin. So, of course, you have heart attacks and strokes and stuff. So the fat, miserable people, they die out a long time ago. The only ones left are the fat, happy ones. So if you are a little bit overweight, please laugh a lot. It will save your life. So only the fat, happy ones are left. The fat, miserable ones, they died a long time ago. But the thin, miserable ones, yeah, they're thin because they don't eat very much. And so they've got clean blood going through them, but only got small vessels. That's the only way they can survive. That's logic. That's science. Anyway. Ajahn, holiest of all donuts. Who from the book of verses of monks and the disciples, arahats, have inspired you the most? And why? Who has inspired me the most? As well as Santa Claus. It's not so much monks or nuns inspire me. It's just teachings, acts inspire me, not people. So that's one of the reasons why you probably say, oh, the Buddha, oh, of course, I mean, it's incredible stuff which he taught, and Ajahn Chah, amazing. That monk I said the other day, Ajahn Tate, whoo, incredible monk. But the inspiration doesn't come from people. It comes from acts of body and speech. It's what people do inspires me, not who they are. It's one of the reasons why when you take refuge, you know the three refuges? What are the three refuges? In the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Not in a person. You don't take refuge in Ajahn Chah. I don't take refuge in my teacher. You shouldn't take refuge in Ajahn Brahm. You should take refuge in the Sangha, all of your teachers. And then the Dhamma, what's more important, the teachings. And also the Buddha who started this. That's where we take the refuge, and that is very meaningful then. So not in people, but in acts of kind, inspiring speech and kind, inspiring actions. That's where we have inspiration from. In meditation, I have heard of the word bhavanga. Ooh. Maybe mistaken, but I thought it means being in an unclear state, like floating on a cloud, drifting from the meditation object. When one becomes fully relaxed, can you please comment? That's a term from the Abhidhamma, so it's not part of the Buddha's teachings. And sometimes they decide that that's when, that there's almost like a gap between your conscious awareness. The consciousness is sort of turned off for a little while. I'm talking about your main mental consciousness and you're just nowhere. And that's what they call it. But that's nothing which is really important. The most important thing is your awareness being really strong, alive, awake, and just being here. Even though your focus may be on just one thing, in the mental states, the deep meditations, it's not unconscious. Other people may think you're unconscious. You're having a wonderful time inside. But somebody starts calling for you. Metta-chi. He can hardly hear them. And they think you're asleep. You're not asleep. You're just having a wonderful time deep inside. How is it that monks, I notice, are internally motivated? Internally motivated? How do we become motivated by internal qualities than distraction with external objects, gratification? Well, you think the monks are motivated internally. That's amazing. And then what about the nuns? How is it the monks, I notice, are internally motivated? You never mentioned the nuns. Aren't they internally motivated? Anyway, how do you know anyway? The point is, a lot of times, I think what you mean is what really we find important. They're not things. But just, I'm going to say something interesting. That's like emotions. The emotional intelligence. To know how to make peace, and to know what kindness is, to notice how, I was mentioning in some of the interviews, how to have love towards yourself. What does that mean? And of course, what it means is to have this beautiful attitude. You open the door of your heart to yourself, no matter who you are, no matter how you behave, no matter how stupid your meditation is. If you've fallen asleep, every meditation you come in here for, or you've got totally restless and had these really crazy fantasies which you wouldn't dare to tell anybody about when you're meditating, can you accept that and make peace with it? Can you really make peace with what's happening inside? Or are you always fighting it? Can you accept all the mistakes you make in life? And I've made many, 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 many mistakes in my life. So what's a nice one to... Okay, the pineapple story. You know that one? Yep. So when I was a young monk with Ajahn Chah, it was a poor... Even those days, it was a poor monastery. There was hardly anything there. And so if I needed some soap, you know, to wash with, all you do, you know, you go up to see Ajahn Chah, this big water jar, you know, this big clay water jars, and when anybody came and gave him any dana, any requisites, they just, he put it in there. And so if I needed some toothpaste, I'd say, you know, can I have some toothpaste? I've been seeing Thai. And he's just looking around there, see if there was anything in there, and then just give it to you. And that's actually how we got our basic supplies. So this day I needed soap. And the Thai word for soap is sabu. And I said sapo. It's close enough to me. But sapo meant pineapple. And he looked at me and just, you know, he knew I was a sincere monk. He said, what do you want pineapple for? And I said, to wash. And I made all the actions of washing. And he almost fell off his chair laughing. And for the next 3 or 4 days, he would tell everybody, oh, you know, sort of in England, they're very advanced. They don't use soap like we do. They use pineapples to wash. Because of my stupidity, oh, I gave our teachers so much happiness. They told all these stupid stories of what we got up to. But at least I learned the difference between pineapple and soap. So anyway, that's some of the little things we do. So, but it, the nice thing about that is you could laugh at one another. And nobody would take that, you know, that there was some fault in you. It wasn't like a personal offensive complaint. It was just a reason to laugh. And so we didn't have this sort of idea of like giving offense to anybody. And I thought that's a wonderful way of dealing with sort of some of the silliness and how we learnt. We made a mistake, we were allowed to make mistakes. And once we made a mistake, we learnt from it. And it, in the meantime, we made our teachers so happy. Why did the Buddha prescribe living in the forest? Does it give better energy for jhanas? Thanks very much. What it does, it gives you more seclusion, more quiet. Even in India at that time, well, even now, there's so many people in India. And to be able to get some peace and quiet. It wasn't just forests. Actually, the word, you know, which we have, you know, the Aranya. Aranya was the word for forest. You know, Aranyawasi is a forest dwellers. And the it didn't mean forest, it meant wilderness, not owned and governed by the king. The places where people didn't go. So it meant mountains, it meant caves, it meant forests as well, because there were so many jungles and forests in India. So it was going to places where few other people went. So a good example of this is when I went on my wandering after 5 years basic training, and Ajahn Chah, and I paid respects and said my thanks to Ajahn Chah for going off for a year with his permission, and he gave me lots of advice. Not just if the elephant puts its trunk under your mosquito net, to bang it if it's a young elephant. If it's a big elephant, don't try and bang it. But just to scare it away so its mother doesn't come and just do damage to you afterwards. But he gave so much advice. And one of those pieces of advice, he said, if ever you want some peace and quiet to meditate, find out from the nearest village where the cremation grounds are, where the cemeteries are. Because then the villagers will never come even close to you. I always remembered that. So sometimes I would go to places to try and escape from people, get some peace and quiet, and go to the places where there was the cremations. And so at night time, no one would go there. And I wasn't afraid of the ghosts. You know why I wasn't afraid of the ghosts? Because I couldn't understand what they're talking about. They spoke Thai, I spoke English. No, I understood exactly what was going on there. But so that's often I would do that, try and find the quiet places. Forests were like that. So a few people would go in the forest. So that was a quiet place to go. So that's one of the reasons why the Buddha advised to please don't go too far away from your food source and from your devotees and people you can teach and help and inspire. That's also part of my job and every monk's job, to inspire others. So don't go too far away, but don't go too close. So you may notice Bodhinyana Monastery, it took a long time to find that land. And we try to find roughly an hour, just give or take 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there, an hour from the CBD. Not too far away. If it's too far away, then people won't come and feed you and you won't be able to go and teach and help and serve others. Too close and it becomes too sensuous and too noisy. So just far enough away, but not too far. And that's why we chose the land where Bodhinyana Monastery now is. And a quiet place. That place before, it was like the owner had sheep and cows on the property. But he said it was such a hilly property, he could never find those cows. There's too many places they could hide. And so because of that, it was just not really worthwhile for him, especially as he started to get old. So he wanted to sell it, but no one wanted to buy it, because no one, it's a terrible place to run cows and cattle or sheep. But it's a great place to run monks. So that's where we bought it as a monastery for the monastics there. So that's why we go to the forest. It also means that you can come and stay here as well. Now I'm sure you've noticed just how peaceful this place is. Even in Thailand it's much noisier, especially in the evening, because you have all the animals, especially things like cicadas. And it's really noisy. But down here, there was no flight paths down here. So we're not underneath the sort of jet engines. So it's a very peaceful place. It's a bit of a ways away from the main highway. Obviously we've got Kingsbury Drive up there, but no many people go up there. It's a quiet place. And so that's why we built this jhana grove for you. For lay people, so you can come and practice. And your food. Where did your food come from today? You see those people offering the dana? Mostly Sri Lankans. There's a couple of Malaysians as well, or Singaporeans. They came because they come on retreats as well. When they come on retreats, other people come and feed them. So when you're on this retreat, they go and feed you. It's amazing. You come here and that food, when Bianca's not cooking, there's always somebody coming and offering you food. And they don't get paid. It's all for free. This beautiful arrangement where we share our food. And they come all the way from inside Perth. Most of those were retired engineers. And then they're with their wives, and they come and feed you. Was it nice food today? And they did that specially for you. And what a wonderful thing that is. And sometimes when you remember that, you feel so much gratitude. Sometimes in some places of the world, it's okay to take food to monks or to nuns, but to you. Isn't that really cool? And there's a retreat on, and so they get told, and say, yeah, we'll do Sunday, we'll do Monday, we'll do Tuesday. So Bianca just arranges things a lot. And if there's a day when it's not much food, she can make a little bit extra for you. But so much of this food comes from our people who just have a day off or they're retired and they come and feed you. It's beautiful. So it always inspires me, just people's kindness. Anyway, that's why we live here, it's peaceful. What is the best way to start meditating when the mind is agitated? Body sweeping seems to take too much effort, so later I have been giving attention to whatever feeling or emotion comes up. That sounds good. I do get up after 50 minutes, that's okay, feeling relaxed, but I can't seem to remember having had very peaceful states in my meditation. It seems a bit dull, like I have had a relaxing nap. What's wrong with that? Is there anything I can do to make the quality of my meditation sharper, more alert and aware? No, just keep carrying on. It will get more alert by itself. The more you do, the more you'll stop meditation happening. Okay, this is Ajahn Chah's simile. He didn't use the holding up a cup, how can I make it still, which I did with the first night. He would just use his hand and wave it back and forth like this. And he said this represents a leaf on a tree or on a bush. It only moves because of the wind. If the wind stopped, it would move less and less. And after a while, it would become perfectly still. Because that's the default state of the leaf. That's its natural state. It is still, it's only something outside of it makes it move. The wind. He said, that's the same with your mind. Its natural state is to be still. Its default state. It only moves because of wanting something. When you want something, you do something. But wanting is the core. Craving, the cause of suffering, makes you do something. So when you stop all that wanting, then your mind, still moving, but less and less and less. Until, because you don't want anything, you're so totally content and easily satisfied. Where did we hear that a few minutes ago? In the Metta Sutta, yeah. Content and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. Don't demand anything. And that means that you've no wanting, and your mind becomes so incredibly still. And just to notice that, any time you've had a really lot of peace on this retreat or on previous retreat, why? You find you didn't want anything. You know, you were meditating, trying this and trying that, and then, okay, enough. Just go and sit down and have a cup of tea. And sitting there just watching the birds and became very peaceful. Why? Because you stopped wanting. What was it? This was one of the best cases. I can't really tell too much, but you know, she is a nun at Dharamsala. But when she was a layperson, she was at one of my retreats in Thailand, and she was a very smart girl, very motivated, meditating. She went on one of my retreats and just so frustrated. 9-day retreats, and just at the end when we finished the retreat, you know, she was nowhere. And so, you know, totally sort of disappointed, giving up. And then, you know, she came to see me an hour later after we finished the formal part of the retreat, because her taxi was not supposed to come and take her to the airport for another hour. So she had 1 hour to kill. And so we might as well meditate. And for the first time in 9 days, she wasn't trying. She was just killing time. And after that meditation, she came up to me. And I was sitting having a cup of tea or some drink, sitting on a chair, and she knelt on the ground, put her hands up. I can't really say who it is, and I can't really repeat it, but she was so blissed out. She'd done all that hard work for 8-9 days, and then she gave up. When she gave up trying, that's when she got deep meditation. First time in her life. It's interesting. I tell that story on purpose. Because what is it that one of the famous monks in the time of the Buddha, Ananda, he was with the Buddha for 25 years as his attendant, listening to everything the Buddha said. And so once the Buddha passed away, Ananda wasn't enlightened yet. Imagine you've been 25 years with the best teacher in the world at the time, and you're still not enlightened. So when the Buddha died, I thought, well, that's it, I've had it. How am I ever going to get enlightened? But the Buddha told him, oh, you will, you know, but he said, well, yeah, he would say that, wouldn't he? So he was pretty depressed. But then, make it worse, the Mahakasapa decided, you know, to make sure we find out, you know, keep all the real core teachings of Buddhism, we'll have like a conference and to collect all the teachings and affirm them all. And let's get 500 fully enlightened people to Sangha to actually to do this conference. But they said, what about Ananda? He's not enlightened, but he heard so much. He's sitting next to the Buddha for 25 years. So we have to invite him even though he's not enlightened. So they made an exception. Everybody, 500 enlightened beings, except for Ananda. So 499, and he was the one who... Imagine that was you. Imagine how you'd feel if, at the end of this retreat, I made the announcement that everyone on this retreat was fully enlightened, except for you. How would you feel? Oh, that really hurts. Oh, why not? So that's how Ananda felt. So the night before the conference was going to be held, he thought, right, I'm going to go for it. Meditation or bust. And if ever you ever think of doing that, okay, it's full moon night, I'm really going to go for it tonight. I'm going to get something on bust. Every time, you will bust. And that's what poor Ananda, the morning sun came up, it was dawn, he was nowhere. Still as unenlightened as when he started. So what did he do? He said, oh, Jesus, I'm hopeless. So it's early in the morning, I got another hour or two. So he decided to go and take a nap. So he went to his room. And just before his head hit the pillow, he became the 500th enlightened arahat. So he could go to the conference with full confidence. And according to the story, he thought, well, you know, you don't go around saying, look at me, I'm an arahat. So he decided to deliberately go late to the meeting. So they were waiting, all the other monks, led by Mahakasapa, was waiting, and he hadn't turned up. So they closed the door and locked it. And as soon as the door was locked, a few minutes afterwards, then Ananda came in through the keyhole. He made an appearance. Said, ah, well done, Ananda, you're enlightened too. Welcome. That's how he announced his enlightenment, by coming into the meeting when the door was locked through the keyhole. That's pretty impressive. So if you want to prove that you're enlightened, we lock all the doors and see if you can come in through the keyholes. But why did that happen? It was because Ananda was trying. And he gave up, just like that nun. She gave up, just killing time, just waiting for the taxi. So she let go. But when she let go, that was when she got a deep meditation. But Ananda let go, give up, I can't do it. And then he got enlightened. Do you get the message? So, tomorrow, please, if you're not getting enlightened, you're getting really stressed out, you're not getting anywhere, try the Ananda method. Go and take a nap. It didn't work. So obviously the more times you try that, you know, the increase the probability of it working. The more lottery tickets you buy, the more chances of winning. No, it's actually where it's coming from letting go. Ajahn, during meditation, how do we focus when negative emotions come up? Negative emotions come up, they're not yours, they're just emotions. You just watch them. They're here anyway, so what else are you going to watch? So, oh, I haven't. Oh, I'm going to go over time again. Okay, the empathy questions. Remember that little story by Tolstoy? It's in the opening the door of... No, it's Opening the Door of Your Heart or Goodbye, Who Knows? It's one of them. Anyway, one of those books, it really inspired me. Emperor had... It was up to here with religion, always arguing with one another. So he decided to invent his own religion. So he decided there's only three real questions you really need to know the answers for. You know, practical, down to earth, scientific. The three questions were, when is the most important time? Second question, who is the most important person? Third question is, what is the most important thing to do? The when, who, and what. And eventually he found the answers, and it was, you know, from a little kid, from life. And there were amazing answers. The first question is the easy one. When is the most important time? Answer?
Now.
Exactly. So people sometimes ask me, when is the best time to meditate? The answer?
Now.
No. When's the worst time to meditate? Later. Yeah. It's easy to remember, so do it now. That's the only time you ever have. So, I'm going to skip one. No, let's just go as Tolstoy wrote it. Who is the most important person? Oh, it's interesting, you haven't read this before. My goodness, that's a wrong answer. It's not yourself, you arrogant, egotistical. The most important person is the one right in front of you. So you're the most important person in the world for me right now. Because you're right in front, so I give you full attention. Now you're the most important person. I close my eyes. Now I am the most important person now because I'm the only one who's here when I close my eyes. So it's a beautiful answer, the one right in front of you. And many times in my life, you felt rejected. People just weren't listening to you. They want to get rid of you. You had more important people to talk to. How does that feel when that happens to you? Imagine you came to the interview. So you again. Imagine I said that to you. That would be terrible. No, because whoever you are, no matter how many times I've seen you, and if you're right in front of me, I try and really give you importance, that you really are important to me, whoever that happens to be, right now. What's that got to do with the meditation question? What's in front of your mind right now? To me, that's the most important meditation object in the whole world. Negative emotion, if that's in front of my mind right now, that's important. So I don't chase it away. I don't diminish it or demean it by saying, get out of here, that's not real me. If it comes up, if it's here, it's right in front of me, I give it importance. Now you know what mindfulness is. You're not just aware of the nice stuff. Every stuff which comes up, I give it importance. So what do I do with it? The answer to the third question, what's the most important thing to do? And the answer was to care. Caring is a beautiful word. It's halfway between mindfulness and kindness. In other words, it is kindfulness. You're caring for this moment with some emotional sort of loving kindness. So whatever comes up, I might not like it, this is an emotional defilement or a bad memory or pain or whatever it is, it's here, so it's right in front of me, I give it importance, it's happening right now, and I care for it. As if I respect it, it's come to teach me something, I'm not quite sure what, but it's here and teaching me something, so you can stay. And the story which I did once, when I was by myself, left the monastery in Thailand, and I found this beautiful, it was just idyllic for a monk who was born in England. It was in the middle of a tea plantation in the north of Thailand, up in the mountains where it was cool. The lay people, they weren't interested at all in listening to Dhamma, they just wanted to feed me. That was really good. I get fed without doing any work. I know they always say there's no such thing as a free lunch, but sometimes there is. Monks. So 3 months, and it was a beautiful monastery, but it was abandoned. No one wanted to stay there. And I asked the lay people, why aren't there more monks here? This is perfect. They said, because it's too quiet. I thought, wow, this is for me. But there I was, after 2 or 3 weeks, I started getting restless. After 4 weeks, the thoughts were just racing through my mind. Really a lot of restlessness. But the worst part of it, the type of thoughts which were going through my mind, they're what I call unmonkish thoughts. Started thinking about old girlfriends. I was 5 years as a monk. I was only about 28, 29. So, no, still young and handsome and just... Oh, stop it, Ajahn Brahm. I want to be a monk. And then said, I wonder if she's still available. She said, no, stop it. And I really tried to get rid of those thoughts from my mind, but they got stronger and stronger and stronger. And I just couldn't watch my breath. Okay, watch your breath. I'm breathing in, breathing out. And oh, she was really nice. Oh, stop it. And as it got like that for about 3 or 4 days, and because I was by myself, I had no one to talk to. I was too ashamed to talk to the lay people about that. So they were feeding me. So what am I going to do? So I went, one day I was went so sort of desperate for some sort of help, I went to the main hall, bowed 3 times to the Buddha and said, help! And it worked because I got this great inspiration. The inspiration was to do a deal, a compromise. And a compromise was that I'd watch my breath and meditate properly for most of the day, but from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. every afternoon, I'd allow my mind to think whatever it wanted. The weirdest sexual fantasy, weird stuff, I didn't care. I would not control you 3 to 4. You can think whatever you like. That's my sexy thought time. That's what the deal was. So, meditating, it didn't exactly work the way I expected because my mind was still as crazy as ever. Just trying to watch my... It's not 3 o'clock yet, but still the thoughts would come in. Then it got to 3 o'clock. I had to keep the other side of the bargain, so I went to my room, leant against the back wall, put my feet out. Okay, you can think whatever you want now. And for the next hour, I watched every breath without any problem whatsoever. Where did those sexy thoughts go? When I let go of trying to control my mind, you can come in if you want. But they didn't want to. My mind was so peaceful. No effort required at all. Just watch this breath, that breath. That really shook me. I enjoyed it, obviously, and I thought, now I know where those restless, sexy thoughts came from. I was trying to control my mind. The more I tried to control it, the more I was feeding those thoughts. When I let go, they all vanished. Do you understand? Give that a try sometimes. Amazing how it works. How can we help people who have become spirits? Well, please don't drink them. I know one person who became a spirit. His name was Johnny. Johnny Walker. If a person has died and become a ghost or something, sometimes you can help them. Remember what I said about ghosts, that you've got more power than they have. So if you don't want to help them, you can send them away. And they have to leave. So be forceful. Don't be afraid. Say, out, now. But if you want to really help them, just give them some loving kindness and share merits with them, because a lot of times they haven't got enough good karma to get a proper rebirth. So then you just give them some extra good karma so they can get a good rebirth. And you've been meditating for 2 or 3 days, that's amazing good karma. So you've got heaps and heaps of good karma there. So if it may be like a mother or a sister who's passed away, especially recently, just say, now the call of the good karma which we've made today, even today, I dedicate it to you, so please receive it. Just like you can give somebody just, you know, a gift of $100 or $1,000 or take them out to lunch or whatever, you can do that to your loved ones. And they receive it and they got all this extra good karma which they can use for their good purposes to get out of, you know, to get a proper rebirth. You have, well, you've got the demon stories. You have mentioned a story in which a Thai girl has protection against a demon because she had kept good precepts, and another similar story in which a spirit medium was unable to penetrate a protective shield of a former nun. However, does keeping good precepts protect us from tyranny governments? What it does do is protect you against overreacting to tyranny governments. I ask because it seems a lot of early Christian saints were tortured to death by the authorities. May I know your view on this? Sometimes, what's the job of being a monk? It's actually to lead by example. So when people really misbehave, sometimes you do have to stand your ground and say, okay, no, you misbehaved. But don't just criticize the person. This is what the Buddha said in a Rana Vibhanga Sutta, and I was really inspired with this. It's a sutra on non-conflict. So you never criticize a person, you only criticize acts. It's a bad act to do that. Because sometimes, when I started going to prisons to teach, these were supposed to be some of the really bad people. And over here, it's great in Australia, they send politicians to jail. There's one jail which I used to go to, what's it called, the Canning Vale jail? Casuarina? No, not Casuarina, it's called something else. But anyway, that when I first went in there, you could see it was a new prison when I first went in there to teach, and there was the big plaque. It was opened by the Honourable something-something, because he built it, he was the Department of Prisons or whatever, and a couple of years later, he was one of the inmates there. Well, that was really interesting. Even though you're a politician, you can still go to jail. Acts, bad actions, bad speech, illegal stuff, you criticize that, but not the person. Because there's more to them than that. All those years when I went into the prisons to teach, I've never, ever seen a criminal inside jail. I've never seen a murderer. I've never seen a thief, a rapist, or a fraudster. I've never seen those. What I've ever seen is a person who murdered somebody. I've seen a person who stole, but never a thief. So sometimes somebody does something bad and we think that's exactly who they are. They're a bad person. They're not. They're a person who's done bad things. They're much bigger than those acts. So if you can actually teach from an angle like that, it totally changes. And in the old days that people did have a much better way of dealing with these problems. I say that because I saw this when I was in Thailand. I wrote about this story over in Opening the Door of Your Heart. When I first went to Thailand, that was just towards the end of the Vietnam War. So within days, if you remember that history, Laos, Cambodia and Vietnam fell, the capitals fell to the communist troops there. And according to the embassies in Bangkok, we were next, Thailand. So we all had to register with our embassies, and there was an evacuation plan, because if you look where Ajahn Chah lived, in the northeast in Ubon, the distance from Ubon to Bangkok was twice the distance to Hanoi. We were far closer to those communist regimes. And so it was a real danger. And that wasn't the main danger, though, because the communist troops over in those countries, in Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia, were basically exhausted. Just taking over those countries and just arranging government in those countries took so much that the Thai generals would tell us, look, they're not going to invade. That's not the problem. The problem is that they've got all these spare weapons and they're sending them into Thailand for the local insurgents. And at that particular time, there was because the generals would come and talk to Ajahn Chah, and I knew enough Thai, I could understand exactly what they were saying. And in those first 5 or 6 years as a monk, there were places called pink areas of Thailand. And let's say, so that's where the mostly students, but also other disaffected locals, were in open rebellion against the government, getting all their arms over from across the border and fighting. And they would kill soldiers, they would even kill monks. So when I was around that area, just on my walkabout, wandering the what they call Tudong, that I had to register and just see the Thai monks and see the local police and say, is this area safe? I said, oh, this area is safe, but that hill over there, that's where the communists are. And that surprised me. You know exactly where they are? I said, yeah, we know where they are. We know who they are. But we don't do anything. We just watch them. And because they had this three-pronged strategy. This was the official strategy in the northeast of Thailand at that time. Non-violence. Because they knew if they went in there with their armaments, which were from the United States, far more powerful than what was coming across from the border, they could actually kill so many people, but for every person they killed, they would have three or four brothers who would join up against the government. So one of the soldiers told me, because they would come and have a chat. It was really cute, because in the jungles, they'd have a look for you. They had their M16, but when they came close to a monk, they would never wear armaments. They put them on a tree, and then they'd come closer, take off their shoes, bow three times, and then just have a chat. You know, without their armaments, because that was almost offensive to speak to a monk with carrying arms. So they would tell me what was going on. Oh, yeah, they're in the village. No, the communists are over there, so don't go over there. This area is safe. And they also said that sometimes they were on duty by the village. They see the communists come down to get some rice or to get some food from the village. And he said all he'd ever do, he'd show them the new watch he'd got, show him the new radio he'd just bought. This was the soldiers saying this, because the economy was improving and the government was looking after the poor areas. Especially at that time, the king of Thailand was actually putting forth it through roads, medical centers, electricity, and also like dams, reservoirs for greater irrigation so they could actually get a secure source of rice. And the northeast, the remote areas, were actually being developed and the economy was improving. So the villagers weren't interested in joining the communists because actually they quite liked the government they had. But they wouldn't fight them. They just said, oh, yeah, no, you can have some rice. Look what we've just bought. They were being friends. So they're addressing the core problem. They were actually developing poor areas. There were no violence. And the last thing they had was amnesty. Whenever you want to give up your machine guns, you just give them up and just go back to your village. No interrogations, no put in jail, even though many of these had killed villagers and monks. So, total amnesty whenever you had enough. And so little by little, with amnesty, you know, with no questions and with non-violence and with addressing the core problem of the poverty in those areas, the people, there was no point in fighting. So they all joined their villages, went back to their universities, until there was hardly any of those communist insurgents left in Thailand, until eventually the leaders gave themselves in. These were the heads of insurgents. They were Thai nationals who had for years tried to overthrow the government of Thailand and change it into a communist state. So what do you think the government did with those? Amnesty. They were totally forgiven. And not educated or put in jail for a few years. Okay, you know, you try to do your best, and we don't agree with how you did that, but you've obviously got incredible skills. So please, we're going to employ you in our government. And so they offered them jobs, senior jobs, in the government civil service. And I remember just telling that story over in Canberra, and the Thai consul was actually at that talk, the Thai ambassador, sorry, and he stood up. He said, can I ask a question? He said, yeah. He said, I want to add something to that story. Because two of those leaders, at that time when the ambassador stood up to ask his question, he said, two of those leaders are now ministers in the government. The current governor of Thailand at that time. They were just such hard workers. They were willing to sacrifice their lives for what they believed in. Why waste somebody who was just so dedicated and so motivated, who could organize these troops out in the jungles of disaffected soldiers and other people? Why waste that incredible talent? Bring them inside. Employ them. So people who would normally have been put against the wall and shot, they were given posts in the government and they rose to become ministers. So it's a beautiful story. So that's actually how to deal with tyrannies. Where was the tyrant? They got incredible amount of motivation and dedication. But just they got a bit of a wrong view, that's all. So change their view, but keep their good habits. What do you reckon? All the sort of terrorist leaders, are they bad people? I've never seen a criminal yet. I've seen people who've done bad things, not criminals. What do we do when we feel restless during meditation? Well, just be restless. It's come up, it's the most important thing in the world, restlessness. So just be restless. Don't fight it. If you don't fight it, if you make peace with it, the restlessness becomes peaceful. Okay, here we go. The story of the monster. There was an empress, and one evening she went to a talk in a Buddhist center. Why not? You know that just, even in, I don't mind saying this, in Malaysia, in Johor Bahru, in JB, in the Metawana, it was a Metawihara, I think, over there. So I remember going to, actually, I couldn't give a talk there because there's too many people, so they hired a hotel. Oh, I didn't really hire it, I think the owner was a Buddhist, so he just offered it for the evening, making some good karma. And just beforehand, the organizer said, no, please come over here. This, the, was it, not the, is it the Sultan? Yeah. Not the, who's the head of the, yeah. Yeah, Sultan. The Sultan's daughter's here. She wants to listen to your talk. And they have to be Muslim. And you're not supposed to be able to give talks to Muslim people. We said, because it's the Sultan's daughter, you don't have to worry about anything. So she came to listen, you know, to the talk, and she really liked it. She said, oh, thank you so much. She came twice. You know, the next time I went over there to give a talk. Why not? It's a good talk. Why not come and listen? So anyway, because, you know, she was the Sultan's daughter, she didn't have to worry about the police. More like the police had to worry about her. So that, and what's it got to do with restless? Oh yeah, the empress who went to who went to the temple. When the empress went back to her palace, she found in her absence this big monster had come into the palace. This monster was so ugly, so big and so violent that the guards were scared. They hired security, but sometimes the security think, oh no, this is too much for us. So the guards of security, they hid in the broom cupboards, underneath the tables, behind the big flower pots, anywhere to hide because they were afraid this monster was really just a piece of like walking fear. You looked at it, ugh. And so the monster walked right into the center of the palace, into the throne room, and sat on the emperor's throne. And that was just too much. So all the guards, they came out from the broom cupboards. The soldiers came out from underneath the tables. They said, that's too much, get out of here. You can't do that, that's our empress's seat. Get out, now. And every unkind word, every unkind gesture, even unkind thoughts, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more frightening and even more smelly. So by the time the empress came back, this monster was huge. I mean, really big, taking up half the throne room. And it was just so violent. Oh, it would just make, you know, people, was it Die Hard or Wonder Woman, would make them start shaking. You know, superheroes could not see something like that. That was really violent. And smelly. The stench coming off this monster was so bad that the maggots which were crawling over its skin started to throw up. Even the maggots couldn't take that smell. So when the empress came in, she saw this huge, ugly, stinky, violent, aggressive monster. Ugh. So what did she do? Well, she'd just been to the temple. People who come to the Buddhist temple are wise. So she took one look at the monster and said, "Welcome. Monster, why have you waited such a long time to drop in for a visit? Has anyone got you something to drink here? You know, some water? We've got some rainwater, it's very pure. Would you like a cup of tea or some mango juice or some orange juice? We've got so much. Has anyone got you anything to eat yet?" She wasn't playing a game. She was sincere. She was welcoming the monster. And every kind welcoming word, the monster shrank, got an inch smaller, became less violent and less smelly. And the soldiers and ministers and security, when they saw what was going on, they went, "Ah, that's why we have such a wise woman as our empress." So straight away they understood. So they got, "Do you want a cup of tea? We have condensed milk. It's really healthy for you. Would you like," someone said, "how about something to eat? A pizza. We can order a pizza because pizzas come in monster size." I said, "Oh yeah," said the monster. Every time they're really kind to me, he shrank a little bit more. And some of the big soldiers said, "Oh, you know, you've got such a huge head on there that you must need a neck massage." They started, and all the, imagine these monsters with such huge heads. Of course they get sort of aches and pains in their shoulders. So the people gave them, said, "Oh, just a bit over there. Oh, that's really, thank you so much. Oh, that's so nice." And someone gave them a foot massage. And not someone, actually, it'd take about 20 soldiers on each toe. They're so big. And they gave him a nice foot massage. He was enjoying every bit. And every time they were kind and good to him, he shrank a bit more. And before the pizza arrived, it takes a while to deliver these things. They've got to cook them first of all. And before the pizza arrived, the monster was back to the size when he first came in. He shrunk. And they were just even more kind to him, really kind, just, you know, not too many people, just giving him a foot massage and giving him a nice cup of tea. And do you need more sugar in it? Or do you like honey? Or would you like some cakes? We've got some cakes. They were so kind to this monster, he goes smaller and smaller and smaller. And before the pizza came, he got so small that one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. Now that is based, with a lot of additions, on a story in the suttas. The Buddha called that an anger-eating monster. It lives on ill will and anger. You give it ill will and anger and it gets a bit bigger, more ugly, more violent, more smelly. You give it kindness and it retracts and gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it disappears. The story of the anger-eating monster. So that is why when we care about what's happening and we're kind to it, the problem gets less. Restlessness is an anger-eating monster. Get out of here, you don't belong. I'm on retreat, I don't want to be restless. The restlessness will get worse. So welcome it, thank you. Thank you, restlessness, for coming to visit me. Okay, now what do you want to give me today? And so kind to it that it starts to disappear. You get angry at it, it gets worse. And that's a great story of the angry-eating monster. I find my depression gets better with meditation. Yeah, that's what the scientists say. How much meditation should I aim for per day to maintain the best level of mental energy for someone with depression? Just meditate once a day in the now. I don't know why people get prisoners of time. That causes depression. So an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. You've only got one moment in your life, which is called now. Do it now. Don't have to have clocks. I think, is it still in there? You know, that big clock in there? That now is the only time you have? Yeah. So that's all you need. Just now. Ajahn, where is the mind? To the eastern it is in the heart. To the western it is in the brain. Thanks. We're not in the east. We're not in the west. We're in the south. So I'm going to ask you a question now. And you have to make an answer. Okay. So don't do it yet. If you're more happy than sad, put up your right hand. If you're more sad than happiness, put up your left hand. If it's totally even, put up both hands. Okay? Instructions clear? More happy than sad, right hand. More sad than happy, left hand. If it's even, just both hands. Okay? Put it up. Keep it up. With your finger now, please point to that happiness because you've got your right hand up. Where is it? Where is that happiness? Happiness lives in the mind. If you can point out where the happiness is, you can point out where the mind is. You can't point it out. It doesn't live anywhere. You are in the mind, not the mind in you. Remember, I told that story the other day, surely, didn't I, about what's the biggest thing in the world? That kid's story, I think the first night. I'll tell it again very quickly. 5-year-old kid, primary school, the teacher said, what's the biggest thing in the world? My daddy, elephant, mountain. This little kid said, my eye. Why do you say your eye? Because my eye can see her daddy, can see an elephant, can see a mountain, so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye is the biggest thing in the world. Great piece of logic, except not quite right, because your mind can see real and imaginary things, and all the other senses too can fit into your mind. So, if everything you can ever perceive, know, think about, real, imaginary stuff, if all of that can fit into your mind must be the biggest thing. Not the biggest thing in the world. Because the world, the universe, this cosmos and parallel cosmoses, all of that can fit into your mind. Therefore, your mind is the biggest thing. So you can never point to it. It's too big. You are in the mind, not the other way around. Hee hee hee. Okay, I better hurry up with these, otherwise I'll get in trouble again. Ego. What is the right amount of ego to have? Ego, she go, we must all go. He go. She go. Okay, well, I try my best to make it nice and light for the evenings. But anyway, it's no ego. Asking thus with the assumption that we need ego to be confident with ourselves? Nah, you don't. Did the Buddha have an ego? He was pretty confident. So that is an assumption which is not really correct. So when your ego goes, and there's no one, basically no one there, you can have much more fun in life, much more confident. A good example of that, I remember, I was telling the monks this the other day, that one of the first really big talks which I gave was in Singapore, about 4,000 or 5,000 people in Suntec Convention Center. That's a lot of people. And there was no sort of support group. There's a big seat up there. I think Angie Monksfield just gave the introduction, and it was just up to me. And I walked in there, and I thought, what am I getting into? That's really dangerous when you talk to so many people. Now, when I told some people you had like these small bands, to do a gig for 5,000 people, I think eventually there was, that's a huge audience. How do you handle that? And I was just walking in. It wasn't scared of, you know, making a mistake. It was actually scared of what this can do to your sense of ego and self. Am I going to sort of lose it and become proud because of this? And then I thought to myself, why am I walking in here? And it's not my teachings, it was how I've been trained by someone like an Ajahn Chah and all these other great teachers who I was trained by. So I said, this is Ajahn Chah giving the talk, not me. And straight away, all that sense of ego, self and fear just totally vanished. I went up to the, then just gave a nice talk for an hour and questions afterwards, and it went really well. Why? It wasn't me giving the talk. There's no ego there. Everything I say, I've been totally brainwashed by Ajahn Chah. And now you are being totally brainwashed by me. So if you go to your school and give a talk in public about what you did over the holidays, summer holidays, or you go and give a talk somewhere about whatever, remember, you've been just brainwashed by me. So he said, this is what, you just give a talk, enjoy it. And then if anyone complains, say, well, don't complain to me, complain to my teacher. Then there's no ego there, and there's no fear. And then you're totally confident. So confidence is our ability in tasks, in the overconfidence in one's ability. So you don't need confidence in your ability. And you can, especially when I say, you know, you're allowed to make mistakes. You know, one of the reasons I found out that works, if you're allowed to make mistakes, you make less mistakes. But if you're not allowed and you're afraid of making mistakes, well, you make a lot. So it's just for an easy life as an abbot in Bodhinyana Monastery. When I tell the monks you can make mistakes, they don't make so many. Which means that I have a much easier life. If you're a CEO of a company or a manager of a little group, just don't tell your workers you're okay to make mistakes. And then they make less. Because they know that, you know, this is the company. If it, you know, if it goes bust, then we all lose. Thank you, Ajahn. Context. TL in love. Afraid they... Oh, context. Oh, fell in love. Ah. What did you fall in love with? That's a problem. Afraid they'd get hurt emotionally. If we go further and they find out who I was in the past, I've accepted, forsaken, learned from who I was. How do I reconcile this and move on completely? You thought, what's the difference between love and just kindness? I will now give you the test. I don't know who, you know, you're in love with, who your partner in life is. Suppose, you know, you're married and you've got this wonderful partner, you know, say just over in Perth. You love them so much. And their happiness is the most important thing in the world to you. So when you go back home, you find a little note saying they've run away with another person. And they're up in, say, where's a nice place? They're back in Broome, having a wonderful time. How would you react? Would you be upset? You'd be angry? Or would you actually think of them as saying, oh, they're having such a wonderful time in Broome, you know, having sexual relationships with somebody else. That makes me so happy that you're happy. Isn't their happiness the most important thing in the world for you? No, it's not. So that means it's attachment. But, you know, if you really do love them, I want you to be happy. So however you're happy, it's fine by me. And if you can send them a sort of a text message, oh, you're having a wonderful time with, you know, that person, that makes me so happy that you're just enjoying yourself so much. Then that is the love which is letting go. Dear Ajahn, the Buddha encouraged the enjoyment of jhanas. On the other hand, jhana meditations are also conditioned phenomena, subject to rise and fall, impermanent, which according to the sutta are suffering. Of course it's suffering, but eating food is suffering. Listening to Dhamma talk is conditioned. That's suffering. It's all suffering. But there's some which is suffering which leads to liberation, and it's suffering which leads to, you know, more getting caught up in it. The jhanas lead out of suffering. Yeah, they're suffering, but it's suffering which ends suffering. That's why you should follow them. Jealousy, what causes it? It's just, well, number one, judging. Ah, what was that story, the best story of jealousy? There were these two sisters. They came for some counselling from me, the Thai sisters. The first was married. She had a Western Australian husband giving her such a hard time. So she wanted to end the relationship. And so I was trying to talk to her, oh, just give him a chance, do it this way, do it that way. So trying to talk her into keeping her husband. Her younger sister, she was trying to find a partner in life. But, you know, she'd go out with, you know, some nice people. But then after about a month, it would all fall apart. She could never get a partner in life. And of course, I saw the obvious solution. Monks can actually see, just, no, we think outside the box. It's obvious, you know, that your elder sister's got a husband she doesn't want. You want a husband. Obvious to me. And then I said, look, if you've got a husband, you're jealous, you know, of people who haven't got a husband because they're free. If you haven't got a partner, you're jealous of people who have because you think that's going to make you happy. And I said, what's really happening there is the elder sister's got what we call husband suffering. If you get married, and many of you are, I've had experience with it, you've got what we call husband suffering. So if you get rid of the husband and you become single, then you have what we call single woman suffering. Either way you suffer, it's just a different brand, a different flavour, like strawberry ice cream and chocolate ice cream. So then after a while I think, oh, cool, what should I do? So she thinks, okay, let's become a nun. And it's true, once you become a nun, then you don't have husband suffering or single woman suffering. What you have is nuns suffering, yeah. Isn't that the case? Yeah, you said, oh, So I thought this when I was a young monk. I was a young monk, I had to work so hard. All these senior monks, all they did was sit up there and talk all day. And they got the best food, they got lots of cushions underneath them, even though they're so fat they didn't need cushions. And I thought, oh, I just want to be a senior monk. Now I'm a senior monk. I have to talk all day and get my photo and sign all these books and, oh, what after this one? And all those young monks are now just over in Bodhinyana Monastery. Ah, oh, he's over in Jhana Grove today. We can just relax. I don't know what they're up to over there. So now I have senior monk suffering. And I just want to be a junior monk. And junior monks have junior monk suffering. They want to be senior monk. Now you get the idea here? It's just wherever you are, you're jealous. Oh, if I can be like him or her, then I'll be free. You're not. You just change suffering, that's all. A different flavour, but it's still suffering. So don't need to be jealous. This is who you are. You're right here, right now, whatever you are, sick, healthy, whatever. Make peace with it. Now's the most important time. Whoever you are right now, right in front of you, most important thing in the whole world, just be kind, be careful of it. What is the correct thinking? I will now teach you. That was correct thinking. Silence. How to deal with inner chats is end them. So enough for now, thank you very much, and get to silence. Where does inner chat get you? It goes on and on and on. It's just like escaping from reality. Expectations. Is it bad to have expectations of self or others? Or, yeah, of course it is. So stop it. Does that really help at all? Not really. What is expectation? Looking outside this moment, looking outside of this reality of now. Don't have expectations, have inspectations. Inspect, look inside, what's going on right now, right here, this moment. Don't expect something to happen. You inspect what is already happening. One is fantasy in the future, the other one is reality of now. Where are you going to get wise? Right here, right now. Inspectations, not expectations. An insight meditation, looking inside. not excite meditation. Don't get excited. Get incited. Okay? If so, how do we keep and reach for higher standards without the guidelines and expectations? If not, how do we balance what we expect with reality? Oh. The story of the executive, she was from Sydney, and she said, look, I know you're very busy, I'm very busy, this, you know, I know this lifestyle. So she said, very quickly, this is my problem. This, she said, is where I am in life. This is where I know I should be. I'm expecting this. I know I can reach this level. And I keep getting up and up, and I'm always reaching my expectations, and I fall down again. It's my life, you know, trying to reach these goals and expectations that I know I should have. And it goes down again. How can I solve that problem? It's really easy. It's obvious. This is where you are, and this is where you want to be. How about moving where you want to be to where you are? Then you're at peace with yourself. Oh, I never thought about that. People always feel that, you know, when you're high, when you're just the boss, when you're really wealthy, even wealthy people, what do they have? Wealthy people suffering. When you're poor, you have poor suffering. When you're in the middle, you have middle suffering. It's all suffering. People sometimes don't believe how much suffering wealthy people have. They have huge suffering. They can't go anywhere without people noticing them and expecting so much out of them because they're wealthy. That's one of the reasons why that story went to this person's house to bless their house one evening. No, one morning, sorry. No joke, when I went to their house, I needed, you know, coming all the way from Serpentine, this was over in Shelley on the river somewhere, I needed to go to the toilet. I said, which is the way to the toilet? She said, it's easy if I draw you a map. I draw you a map, where to go to the toilet, in a house? These days, this was a few years ago, these days big mansions, they come with GPS, so you can find your way around the huge museum. But then afterwards, when I went there and just turned left, here, right there, up the stairs, round the back, somewhere to get to the toilet, when I came back again, just having, you know, chit-chat, I said, how many people live in this house? He said, just me. Oh, and that really shocked me. Only you? It's a huge mansion. So why didn't you have some friends in there? He said, no, I can't trust my friends. They will ask me for stuff, for loans for their business or some investment or something. What about your relations? They even worse asked me for money. She was so rich that she was a prisoner of her house, living there by herself. If you won the lottery and had $30-40 million, that's what life would be like for you. If you're a monk or a nun and got absolutely nothing, you've got a small little cave where you live. That's more than enough for me. And beautiful monks and nuns and lay people friends. That's a wonderful life. No money at all. Desires. Well, that's to be the last. There's quite a few questions left over here, but I'll keep these for tomorrow because it's almost 9:30. Is that okay? Do you want us to go until 10:30? No, 9:30 is enough. Desires. How do we balance our teaching to reduce desires with setting goals in life? For lay people, Dad, what are you setting goals for? Is that what life is all about? If you want to set a goal, I know where your goal is. I know where you're going to reach. If you live in Perth, it's either Karrakatta, Pinneroo, or Fremantle Cemetery. If you want a nice place to live, all you need is 6 foot long, 2 foot wide, maybe 1 foot six high, a box. That's the only house you really need. You're going to spend more time, if you get buried, you can spend more time in your box than you will in any house. So why not invest in a nice coffin? Have you chosen your coffin yet? Well, it's going to happen. So that's my goal in life, to have a nice coffin. You know, people ask me, what do I want? And they, you know, they give me all this tea and stuff and robes and stuff. But you know what I really want? I want a really nice coffin. No, I don't. So what is your goal in life? Is see if you can have less goals and live more in the present moment. Enjoy this moment. Now is the most important time. When we're looking for goals in the future, we're wasting these moments of life. You know, your family, people you love and care for, this moment. Just, you know, you're so busy chasing a goal, you can't even go out and see the moon at night. You haven't got time for that. You're seeking a goal. There was a man, it's an old Zen story, a man who was looking for he didn't know where he left the matches to light the fire to cook his rice. So he was going around his house with a candle, with a lit candle, looking for where the matches were. If he only knew what fire was, he could have cooked his dinner much earlier. What goal do you want in life? Isn't it to be here, to be happy? We know what the real goal is. The only goal is right now. So stay here. Okay. Career goals, personal goals, oh crikey. If you have a career, what do you mean a career goal? What do you want to do? Become the senior abbot of the world? I got my goal. I want to become... Actually, I was telling somebody today this, and it's absolutely true. That to become the Pope, you don't have to be a Catholic. You don't even need to be a Christian. I could actually become the Pope. So I'm just waiting for this one to get a bit older and die, and then I can send him my CV. It's true. I mean, they could elect me, and if I did the right sort of like salesmanship, so what a wonderful thing it would be for the Catholic Church. You know, to show it's supposed to be universal. To get like a Buddhist monk to be the Pope, yeah. And apparently there's no legal impediments at all. It can actually be done. So I just need to convince them it's a good idea. Wouldn't that be a wonderful goal in life? To have a Buddhist monk as a Catholic Pope? Imagine what we could do. That's my goal in life. So it's such an impossible goal. But if you want to be head of the company or a millionaire or something, it's similarly impossible. At least I know my goal is impossible. And you still think it's still credible. Okay, that's enough messing around. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Imagine in the Vatican, instead of hallelujah, you go, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That'll be my goal. Okay, here we go. Sadhu, 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 and hallelujah.